My name is Dawn Mers.
Dawn, it's good to sit down with you here in England, and the sun is not shining right now.
It was trying.
It was trying. Matter of fact, I'd say very trying. Dawn, you knew the Schaeffers at the end of their life.
Yes.
Or at least of Francis' life. So tell me about your initial engagement with the Schaeffers, if you were a Christian or not a Christian. So we'll just start there.
Yes. Well, it's difficult for me to tell you about my relationship with the Schaeffers without first starting with my parents' relationship with the Schaeffers. Mm-hmm. Because they were very influenced by Francis and Edith Schaeffer. So I'll tell you a little bit about their story and how it impacts on mine. My dad was raised in a non-Christian family and went to university, and at the university bookshop picked up The God Who Is There and read it. And he is the first person in his family to go to university. He was studying agriculture. And that book answered all of his questions. He found it very compelling. He had read very few books in his life, but somehow this book at that time was used by the Lord, and he put it down when he finished it. He put it down in his room, and he said, "What do I need to do to become a Christian? This makes sense." And there was a knock on his door, and it was two Campus Crusade guys going around with the four spiritual laws, and they said to him, "Do you know that you're a Christian?" And he said, "Do you know that you're a sinner?" And he said, "Yes." And they said, "Do you believe there is a God?" "Yes." He's just finished reading The God Who Is There. And he ended up becoming a Christian and working with Campus Crusade for a few years. But not at all gifted in a lot of the things that that someone in a ministry like that would need to be gifted in. He was at Vanderbilt University, and the Schaeffers came to Covenant Seminary in Chattanooga and had their first ever conference at Lookout Mountain. And Dad and Mom went to that, and they were met at the door by someone that they thought was the janitor, who just chatted with them. He was dressed in quite funny clothes, and he just chatted with them about, he asked what my dad liked to do with his hands. And that was the perfect question for my dad, who was a builder and a carpenter and a farmer. In a Vanderbilt University leading Bible studies in a way that he wasn't thriving at all. And this person that he was talking to, my dad was talking to, had so much time for him. And then the conference started, and this person went up and got up onto the platform, and it was Francis Schaeffer. And the talk that he gave was "No Little People, No Little Places." Mm. And for my parents, that was the beginning for them of them going back to the farm, going back to working with a local community and working as carpenters in the setting that I grew up in then. But the Schaeffers were such a part for my parents of coming to an understanding of all of life under the Lordship of Christ, and that we can flourish as Christians by doing what we are gifted in doing, and by doing what's at hand. And so I was raised in an environment where questions were taken seriously, and where we really, as a family, sought to grow and to challenge each other and to kind of live as Christians in a way that was thinking and honest and had integrity to it. And one of the things that we would do regularly is go up to the Rochester Labrie, which was just 4 hours away from us. And when I was 7 years old, I had my first interaction with Francis Schaeffer, which was my only interaction, I'm sorry if that's disappointing to you, with Francis Schaeffer, because we went to a conference, one of the first conferences in Rochester, Minnesota, which was when they were... he had been diagnosed with cancer, and so that's why they had begun to put a base down in Rochester, Minnesota, and they had a conference, and it was very well attended. I forget how many, 700 to 1,000, something like that. But my little sister was running and fell on the path, and a couple stopped, and it was Francis and Edith Schaeffer. And they both had so much time for her, surrounded by people who were following them, wanting to talk to them. And instead, they stopped and spent time with my little sister. And Edith fished out this triple antibiotic ointment, and Dr. Schaefer had her on his knee and was talking with her. And my impression of them as a very young child was that these are people who everyone likes. I had seen him up on the podium. I had seen him delivering all of these lectures, and he had time for children at play who had fallen. And as I continued with my interaction later with Edith and my time at Labrie, which has been now a total of 11 or 12 years as a worker at Labrie, one of the things that has made the biggest impact on me is that the Schaefers took people seriously, even young children, and that they took people seriously who weren't just intellectuals, like my father, but taking people for who they were and really wanting to hear from them and be with them and encourage them wherever they were at. So we continued to go to Labrie conferences, which were hosted in Rochester. And through that time, we got to know Edith, who had by that time lost her husband in 83. So in 87, there was a big conference. 88, 89, we would have three conferences a year, little seminars. And Edith was very excited to be a part of them. She would do the flowers, or she would help make the soup or whatever for these meals. And we got to know her. And in 94, she invited me to come and live with her and to be her companion and secretary. She had a full-time, she had a part-time secretary, but I helped with a lot of the secretarial work as well. And so in the end of 94 and in 95, at various periods of time, sometimes for a few months at a time, I lived with her in her home and shared life with her, basically. By this time, she was in her, she would have been 80, late 70s, and early 80s. And she was more needing just life companionship, sort of. And that's really what we shared together, was just did life. Shared all of our meals. I traveled with her when she traveled, and got to just be her friend and her companion. And we really did grow to consider each other as friends by the end of our time together. It continued on through 95, 96, 97, and in 98, then I came over to the English Labrie and became a helper here and was accepted as a worker, a lot of that through her encouragement, and went back to her September through May of 98 and 99, and was in community with her, not living with her most of that time, but sharing life with her. And then from 99 on, I was here at Rochester Labrie, at the English Labrie, and would go and visit her in Switzerland for a week at a time, or sometimes I traveled with her over across the ocean. But that 99 was kind of the end of my time caring for her in her home.
So, since you spent so much time with Edith and pretty close relationship, did she ever give a hint that she had felt that she had sacrificed too much for the ministry of Labrie?
Never even a hint of that. If anything, she longed to give more. And sometimes the times that I felt I was a part of her struggling was because she wanted to be in two places at one time. She was a person of deep, deep faith and deep commitment to the Lord. And her response to life was a big yes, but it was a response to God. And so I rarely saw her stepping back and sort of weighing out carefully what the even the results of a choice would be. She was so wanting to say yes to the Lord, to whoever he brought into her life. She wasn't involved in full-time Libri work at that time. But every relationship was an opportunity. I will tell you one short story, because as her companion and as her friend, I sometimes was concerned for her. Here's a woman getting older, needing rest, showing evidence sometimes of her need for rest, and needing reminders sometimes to have good meals, sort of, and things like that. But every person in front of her was so important to her that she would just do anything to pursue conversation with them. And I would sometimes have to kind of tell her very strongly, it is time to eat. You have to hang up the phone, or that person at the door, we'll say come back later. I'll go say come back later. So oftentimes and the community surrounding her, I was not alone by any means. There was a very strong community of people helping her and caring for her and sharing life with her. And all of us, we would be trying to help her to say no, or to actually sleep on an airplane and not talk to the person next to her, or to just sit back in the taxi and take a breather and not talk to the taxi driver the whole 20 minutes or whatever. Well, one time we were flying to, I think, New York City, and Edith was exhausted. We had had very little sleep, and it was an exhausting, we had had to race to get to the airport, and we got onto the flight, and I was sitting next to her, and all I wanted to do was disappear into my magazine. And she was sitting next to a gentleman who had already disappeared into his magazine, and his body language was so obviously closed. He did not want to have a conversation with this eager elderly woman next to him. And she kept leaning forward and into his space, sort of saying, and where are you headed today? And asking these questions. And she said to him, where are you from? And he said, I'm gonna change it just a little bit, just to get, he said, I'm from Colorado. And he turned his body away again. She said, Colorado? Dawn, we know someone from Colorado. Who is that from Colorado that was just visiting us? And I was like, Anne from Colorado. And she was like, Anne from Colorado. Do you know Anne from Colorado? And he said, no. But she persisted. And he began to slowly open to her questions. And it turns out that Anne from Colorado was the mother of one of the boys that he coached in his soccer team. And he had just asked her with flowers to go out with him. Anne from Colorado. And she had said no because he was not a Christian. And he had all sorts of questions as to why Christianity would matter so much to her, that a single mother with four children who was, and he was an eligible man, why she would say no to him. And Noni was full of care and excitement for him, but then challenge. And they talked for the whole flight. We talked that he carried our bags off the airplane. He walked us in. It was just this reminder to me of, I guess as I think back on our life together, I see that she didn't want to waste opportunities. And she felt very much that the Lord might have placed her in a place in order to have that conversation. And many times it wasn't something that was significant, but there were times like this time when it became incredibly significant to this person that she persisted, and she often did. And somehow the Lord gave her an incredible amount of energy and emotional energy to offer to people, more than her 20-year-old, 22-year-old companion sitting next to her, also hiding behind my magazine.
Well, it's wonderful that you've shared the story of your parents,
Yes. Simply
because it now shows how this information transfers, the influence it had from one generation to another generation.
Yes.
And so the influence of Schaefer, in this case,
Yes. Is
where one generation becomes a Christian,
Yes. And
then the second generation and picking up in the same interest, being involved in LaBrie.
Yes, that's so right.
It's sort of the ripple effect that sometimes we lose sight of. So I'm delighted that you told your parents' story, particularly your dad's story, because it does help to highlight this dimension that sometimes is forgotten.
Mm.
So for you, I not to put you on the spot, but have you, and I'm assuming you've read some of Schaefer's works.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
My question is, if I came to you and I said, you know, Dawn, I'm just really confused. I'm trying to sort this thing out about Christianity. Do you have a book that I could read? Mm-hmm. So we're going to just say that all the only books you have are Schaefer's books on your shelf. So which book do you think you would give?
I would probably give the book that my depending on I would probably want to ask more questions of the person to find out what their questions were, but probably the book that was given to my father, or that my father read, The God Who Is There, I would probably give that, but I would also give another book with it, and that is The Letters of Francis Schaefer that Lane Dennis edited years ago, partly because I think that the ideas of Schaefer are so well laid out in some of his books. Very, very excellent arguments and insightful in looking at people where they are and looking at the things that they're struggling with and the answers that they're seeking. But at the same time, what comes out in his letters is that this was a person who really cares about people and who really cares about those answers and whose arguments for Christianity stem from a real care for the individual in front of him. And that is something that I think you can sometimes not pick up so well in his books that are published, but when you hear him lecturing and when you read his letters to people, you see how integrated he is as a person and how integrated his ideas are with his care and concern and compassion for the individual in front of him. And I think that's what drove a lot of his writing, actually, is the conversations that he had with people where he realized these people need better answers than they're getting. I'm going to seek to pursue this and to write this book or to give this lecture in order to respond to a personal concern as well as a cultural concern that this person in front of me has. So the letters are often when I give to LaBrie students one of his books, one of his many books that might speak to where they're at. I often give a few letters of his to help them realize this isn't just a person whose ideas have an impact, but his care for people is a big part of that too.
Yes, I think that's very, very true. Of course, as you know, in the archives, we have hundreds of these letters.
Yes.
Which I've read through a good number of them.
Yeah.
And one of the things that astounds me is the fact that virtually every evangelical luminary of the latter half of the 20th century was writing.
Yeah.
To Schaefer.
Yes.
Not always in agreement, but always asking for advice, engaging.
Hmm.
But then we have the letters that are written to people, answering their questions, their addressing their hurts.
Hmm.
So I think you're exactly right that we do learn more possibly from the letters.
Hmm.
I think I know C.S. Lewis better.
Yes.
Because I've read the letters.
Yes.
I have not read all three volumes. I've read two volumes. They were my bedtime reading. But I felt that and I would see there very much of a parallel there with Schaefer. You know, last night I spoke something about social media What we don't realize is that's not going to be true of people today.
Yes.
Because we're not going to have the written record.
Yeah.
We're sending an email, we're sending a Twitter, but we're not going to have the record.
Yeah.
That is going to be passed on, that can be read, and many things gleaned from.
Yeah.
So, in you thinking about Schaefer, what would be your response to his book, True Spirituality? Because mm-hmm. Schaefer says, without true spirituality, yes. there would have been no LaBrie.
Yes.
So, could you comment on that in light of what you knew about Schaefer and about Edith?
Mm. Yeah, true spirituality, he said, and Edith said, that's at the very heart of why LaBrie even is in existence. And I think it's probably the book that we hand out the most often here at LaBrie. Because for Schaefer, ideas matter and ideas have consequences. And for Schaefer, the answers that the Bible gives are so worth tackling and wrestling with. But at the very heart is our relationship with Christ. And at the very heart of our being is the need to surrender to him, but also to be known by him and to know who he is. And true spirituality was born, as you very well know, out of his personal struggle. And the integrity that Schaefer had of being a person who took things seriously, things, spiritual things, ideas, relationships, and took them so seriously that he was willing to hold them with open hands. I think that was the springboard for the whole organization of LaBrie that he started and for much of his work. And there's a sense of his integrity that runs through a lot of his work because of that. True spirituality, I think, resonates with so many people because it is about the core, the very core of our being, which is a core that longs for wholeness and healing and health, longs for being known, longs for God, but then is also very messy. And Schaefer acknowledges so well in True Spirituality the messiness of life and the messiness of our longings, and yet lays out so helpfully the hope that is within us as well, if we are Christians. And the very fact that, even though he doesn't dwell on it in the book itself, just really mainly in the introduction, the fact that it came from a very personal place for him, this core of his story, is the flavor, I think, that fills all of LaBrie, even now, of if it's true, it's worth asking hard questions of. If Christianity is true, it needs to be a spirituality that goes to the very core of our being, not something that is just embraced at certain times. And so therefore he was very strong on the sacred-secular divide being something that we really fight against. And I think true spirituality is something that was so close to his heart and to Edith's as well, because she was the woman who heard him pacing back and forth upstairs, and she spoke of it until the end of her life, of that sense that she had of being a missionary child, born and bred with this living faith that was so real to her, but having to allow her husband, who she married, who was a pastor, when, you know, on that trajectory when she married him, having him have to be so honest and so serious about Christianity that he would be willing to give it up, and having her downstairs having to be willing to have him give it up in order to have that integrity. And it was something that they went through very much as a couple together. The questions weren't hers, but they were his, and she wanted, if he wasn't satisfied with the answers and with his relationship with the Lord, she would have encouraged him in walking away. And that was very costly for her, and yet it led to such a depth of their ministry together, because it came from a place of real integrity, I think.
Do you think that because of his own, what he refers to as crisis,
yes,
and what he went through, that prepared him to take other people seriously and to let them talk and even be open-handed, as you say, with his own beliefs? It seems to me that plays a big part in LaBrie and in his own personal ministry.
I think he came to realize that it was essential for true belief to be allowed to face true questions. And he gave a lot of people confidence to actually ask the hard questions. And some of that was through his own example, that he was willing to ask hard questions. He was willing to be humble and to admit that he didn't know, and he would keep looking for answers, that he learned so much from the people that he was with. And he was very eager to do that. I think of his relationship with Ruckmacher and the way that he was such an eager learner, and that's very contagious. And I think that's part of what has been contagious about his ministry of LaBrie, is that the idea that you need to be willing to face the difficult questions in order to have a substantial faith, and in order to have a substantial belief system, and that Christianity is able to take those questions. And some of my favorite Schaeffer encouragements have come both from Edith and from reading Francis Schaeffer's work, have come from the challenge that Christianity can stand up to my questions. I don't need to protect God from myself. And as I've ministered to so many people and shared life with so many people, just giving them that gift, that they don't need to protect God from their questions, that He can stand up to our deep cries of the soul, that has given people courage to have an integrity, to seek an integrity in their faith, that has led to a robust faith rather than a cultural faith or a shallow Christianity, I guess, that is willing to embrace aspects of Christianity but is for whatever reason unable to encounter those depths.
So as you listened to Schaeffer speak, you went to conferences and Schaeffer spoke, was it evident, if you were sitting there as a what we'll call average Christian or an unbeliever maybe, was it evident to you that he knew the scriptures well?
Well,
and how was it evident if it wasn't overt?
Well, I have to be honest in my response that most of my experience of sitting under Schaeffer's teaching has been through his lectures that are recorded. Okay. And I would say that his view of the scripture and his use of the Bible in his deliveries, in his lectures, and in his addresses, he used the Bible so much and had such a high view of it. And many of his lectures, if you look through our tape library, many of his lectures are actually sermons. And even some of his books that ended up being published started as sermons. He had such a high view of the Bible as being the place where we will find our answers. And he really pointed people towards the Bible. But one of the things that I think he also was very aware of is that it's sometimes easy to read the Bible in an inaccurate way, as it wasn't meant to be read. And so he did a lot of work with people of sitting and actually reading the Bible. And I hear many stories of conversations taking place between him and the people who came through the doors of his home, where he actually would open up the Bible and take them right to God's Word, and where he would challenge them with truths from the Scripture And perhaps they didn't even have a high view of Scripture. And he would enter into that conversation with eagerness, I think.
So you see, you're very much or more so part of Edith's life.
Yes.
But that was after Schaefer dies in 1984.
That's right.
So did she have conversations with you about what the past had been like in ministering and living with Schaefer?
Yes, many conversations. I had many questions as well. Mm-hmm. One of the things that ended up having to happen in our relationship that is just worth noting because it's the honest thing is that I went to live with her knowing that this was the Edith Schaefer that my parents, we read La Brie out loud together as a family. There's a picture of my mom on her honeymoon reading What is a Family. Hidden Art had so influenced the home that I had grown up in. And then here was my opportunity to live with Edith Schaefer. Edith Schaefer. And I was Dawn Dahl. Dawn Dahl, this keen, young, vivacious, vibrant young girl. And I had the pedestal as well that I had to fall from. And so did she. And we both came to see each other more and more as real people. And I got to know Edith very much as a real person who was not perfect and whose reflections on the past also it included some regrets, some realistic reflections on what it was like to be married to Francis Schaefer, what it was like to be involved in La Brie, what it was like to grow up on the mission field. And we had a lot of times for reflection, and she came to know me as who I really was too, not just through some lenses of some sort. And I'm really grateful for that because it doesn't lessen in any way my high regard for her. But it does make me realize that it wasn't easy to be in the ministry that she and Francis found herself in, themselves in, that was at their very heart, and yet also cost them very much through their lives. And it wasn't easy to be married to Francis Schaefer. I think anyone who knew them well as a couple knew that it wasn't easy. And knowing Edith well, very well through those years, it wasn't easy to be married to Edith Schaefer either. I have great high regard for them both in the fact that they had a strong and healthy marriage that had many challenges. And the best marriages, I guess, deal with those challenges and face them and don't sort of glaze over them or try to hide from them. Edith reflected, I think, quite realistically about how the costliness of sharing life with so many people and really having a home that was very, very open and had very few margins, how that would leave them sometimes drained and panting on the floor, sort of, and how even though it was their very heart, it was a very expensive life in terms of the way that they shared other people's sorrows so much and other people's questions and really walked along with people in a way that they didn't seek to protect themselves from the impact of sharing life with people. So their home was a home for very intelligent, articulate people. It was also a home for people who were very broken. And they cared for people in very, very simple ways oftentimes. And a lot of it was very non-glorious. And a lot of it was not seen by anybody else. And there was no, I never heard from Edith any sense of regret in the choices that they made as a couple towards La Brie and towards sharing their life in that way. There was an acknowledgement of the expense of it, but never that she would go back and do otherwise. They learned lessons along the way, and those lessons are able to be traced as you see some of the changes that they sought as a couple, as well as that Labrie has sort of grown from being just a place of welcoming anyone to having a bit more structure. Those are things that they learned along the way, and as their ministry changed, they were willing to learn from past mistakes. But their passion, Edith's passion, continued to her dying day. And certainly those years that I shared with her, she continued to want to speak into the lives of anyone that would come across her path. And she was very sought after voice even in her early 80s, as I think of various people that you would probably know from reading the letters, who would call her up for advice or who would come to visit us and have a couple of days with us, just sort of hiding away.
Well, she did, neither of them sat down at the table and penciled this out before it happened.
No.
So it was just taking as it came and choices that were made, and it wasn't a planned path. And I think that in some ways is what makes it so unique, that they were just simply responding to the need at hand and how it developed, as I've read letters and interviewed other people. You think about I think there were five core ideas that were set in place when Labrie started.
Yes.
And one of them was that they would never advertise. And another one was they'd never ask for money.
Yes.
And prayer.
Yes.
That when the need was there, that we would pray for it. So as you had close contact, was that still part of Edith's life?
Very much so. Now, a lot of these faith principles came also from her history too. They were both very influenced, but particularly Edith, by James Hudson Taylor, China Inland Mission, by Amy Carmichael, by George Mueller. These were heroes of hers, and she was still reading their biographies in her 80s, and we would read aloud together, and be encouraged by the story of God's faithfulness to China Inland Mission. And they realized, Edith and Francis together realized, that the Lord, who is faithful to us when we make ourselves vulnerable to Him, that they wanted it to be a very visible sign that the Lord was, this was His work in their lives. So they added that vulnerability into the very structure of Labrie. And for Edith herself, she had, by the time I was living with her, she had an income from royalties that was able to make her live comfortably and not have to wonder where we will get the next check for our food or our rent or whatever, or for traveling. But in her final years, as you know, she was traveling to China. She was doing various things in her final years in Rochester, I should say. Yes. About 15 years before she died, probably in that decade. And that was all a journey of faith and of waiting on the Lord and of seeking His provision and of needing but not asking and receiving and seeing that as the blessing of the Lord to go ahead. So those principles for her were very much life principles, not just organizational Labrie principles. And she did wait. And even in having people like myself come and live with her for a period of time, it was really something that she waited on the Lord for His provision and trusted Him. And was willing to drop very broad hints. Like that wasn't written into the principles of Labrie. I don't think broad hints were allowed, at least in her 80s. but she really had this sense that if it is from the Lord, I want to wait for for him to show that to me. And I know her, I don't know who has her Bible, whether it's in the family or whether it's in the archives, but the Bible that she had in her last decades of life was very, very well marked. And one of the passages that was turned to numerous times by us both, as we read together regularly, was the passage about not lighting your own sparks.
As you're talking, see, that's the,
all the time.
That's the message that comes to me about not the Isaiah text about
Isaiah.
Not lighting your own fire.
She believed in that with great passion. And she had, I think, a very good reason to embrace that text so much, because she was a ball of energy. And she had an ability and a charisma to make things happen. She and Frances were very, very different from each other. And she was the charismatic person who, if she asked you something, you wanted to do it. You didn't know that you wanted to do it beforehand, but by the time she finished asking, you wanted to. And she knew that that was both a blessing and a vulnerability. And her longing was that she would not be one to light her own sparks, even though she had so many ideas and there was so much fire underneath her that energized her and motivated her. But she was a person on her knees waiting. And that was, I saw that woman of prayer every day. And it was a beautiful thing to see that she was someone who had been so shaped by this life of vulnerability before the Lord that she knew that he worked, and she was so confident in that. But she was also confident in the fact that she wanted it to be his work, yes, and not her own.
And yet, Schaefer would say, which I think was so so marked him, that these were the principles for LaBrie, and he would not say that everybody had to do it that
way.
But that's how they felt the Lord was leading them to do that. And you know,
yes.
So what the stories of LaBrie are just telling us what happened. They were very descriptive. They weren't prescriptive.
No, that's true. That's true.
As
opposed to
today.
And that was important
today.
For her. That was very important for her. That it was, she encouraged grandchildren and many, many friends into very different tracks, and was happy to. But they were so non-prescriptive, the Schaefers, and that's one thing that I find very encouraging, particularly coming from a very conservative evangelical background, where prescriptive is safe, mm-hmm. and prescriptive is oftentimes what we look for. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Schaefers' interaction with people was very non-prescriptive and very hands-off and very much encouraging people to really be on their knees before the Lord and seek his favor and seek his voice. And that takes a particular courage and vulnerability that I think was quite contagious for those who were around the Schaefers, and which also led to the birthing of many different kinds of ministries, many different callings of people, because they didn't need to look like the Schaefers and they didn't need to work with LaBrie. They could go and do their own thing and work with their hands and work with their special gifts and do that to the glory of the Lord. And that was really something I think that the Schaefers in their beings encouraged people towards.
But would be very quite directive when he was teaching the Bible.
Yes.
This is what the Bible teaches, but in counseling people,
yes.
and that they did not presume to know what it was that God would have you do,
yeah.
but would be happy to encourage you along
yes.
the way in finding that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We do have his Bible, so it would be very interesting to put the Bible side by side.
Yes.
Because of course his Bible is it's like an annotated text with all these scribal notes on every page.
Yes.
We have digitized that.
Wonderful.
And the quality of the digitized copy is far superior to the original.
Isn't that amazing?
So it's really kind of hard because the ink would sort of bleed on the pages so that
right.
the letters would bleed together. But the archivists, the folks who did this, have just done a marvelous job. I think
Wonderful.
It went through like 3 different steps.
Yeah.
In order to, because as you know, the Bible paper
yeah.
is very thin.
Mm.
So he
yes,
was writing on
yes.
on both sides. So
yes.
you know what happens when you try
yeah,
to scan
it
something,
right
copy
through.
It bleeds through. You don't see any of that.
That is incredible.
Wow.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. Yes.
Edith's Bible would be worth finding
yeah.
because there's a lot of history written, and she
mm-hmm.
she tends to journal through her Bible as well, and so she'll write a date.
He did as well. He kept the record of his reading. He had the history of starting Le Brie, the dates of
yes.
when he left the mission
wow.
board, and all the different dates. I think they get to May, and the final payment is due.
Right.
And you know all that information.
Yes.
All that
Amazing.
Information. You
Amazing.
Know it is in there, and it's just. Well, it's
that
quite.
That was something they shared then.
It's very interesting. Yes, it's marvelous.
Wow.
Yeah. So, as you think about your work at Le Brie, so, in the sense of now, I speak a little more in a professional way, I suppose. The apologetic of Schaefer, you know, his well known. He would not be happy if I called it a method. So we won't call it a method. I don't know what I'm going to call it, okay? His approach
yes.
was something that was referred to as taking off the roof.
Mm-hmm.
Letting people see the conclusion
yes.
of their own ideas, of their own worldview,
mm-hmm.
and letting, not telling them, but letting them see where that failed. So could you speak to that?
Yeah. As a Le Brie worker standing in that heritage, I have to say it's a scary thing sometimes to be willing to encourage somebody to not just give them the answers that I want them to embrace, but to free them and enable them and encourage them to ask the true questions and to actually find their true questions. But it is the place that keeps me on my knees as well, and as it did the Schaefers,
yes.
because I believe that there is true truth and that God is the answer to our deepest longings and our deepest needs. But we live in a society, even more so, I think, than when the Schaefers were at the height of their ministry. We live in a society where people struggle even more to find their questions. And through much of, I think, our ministry here, we are helping people to actually find and articulate the questions that they have and to see the importance of having a hearty faith. That can stand up to the questions that are going to be barraging it. And so I think that desire that the Schaefers had to have such an integrity that we would be able to follow a person's questions to the core question and to realize the absolute essentialness of finding the true answer. Sometimes took Schaefer to a place where he, as you would probably know, because I think you were referring to this, where he realized that he left people with a choice between death and life, because really that is the choice that is before us when it comes to salvation. And I think there's so much contentment with the mediocre and so much desire for ease that people have today, that to walk that path with them and to encourage them towards a deep integrity requires a great deal of commitment and courage. And I am so deeply, deeply encouraged that people long for that integrity and are willing to take that journey and to ask those harder questions and to seek whether there are true answers to the questions. And so I've found Schaefer's passion for truth and his conviction to be something that has given me courage in both my own personal journey towards a deeper, more solid faith, and as well towards encouraging other people towards that. It has been very encouraging for me. And one of my fears is walking with a person towards that brink and having them choose against Christianity. And that has happened. But it's with the realization that this is the Lord's work and this is where the Schaefers had their deepest confidence. Not that the answers, the cultural answers or the biblical answers, not that those would be the things that would compel, but that we also have individual responsibility. And we have the responsibility to care for each other well. And to, and part of loving each other is actually encouraging each other towards truth. And the Schaefers did that with a lot of grace, but also a lot of conviction. And so that has been, for me, such a motivating factor in why I'm working in Libri today, and why it is my heart for us to have a home that is a safe place for people to do that, to actually have the courage to look the real questions in the face, to look their real brokenness in the face and realize that they need healing and they need wholeness.
And Schaefer realized, as you pointed out, that you can't leave a man naked. You must give him the gospel. Now, he may choose to reject it, but you couldn't just leave him naked. Yeah. So it was not something he did in a cavalier way, just something to win an argument. Schaefer would have no part of that, as far as I can tell, none whatsoever. I think the difference today is that, as you've indicated, Schaefer lived at a time when pretty much existentialism was running riot, and there were questions. So people did have them. I don't think today people have the questions. So we have to find the, help them see what the question is and help to crystallize it to say, that's what's at work. Yes. Well, Don, I've appreciated your sharing this. I think it's doubly rewarding for me is to hear the second generation. Yeah. And if I live long enough, which I won't, I might be able to come back and talk with your children.
evangelists, and my kids, racing around the brie.
And I would get a third generation. But that is something that is so telling. And I'm not saying that Schaefer's ministry was the only one that has that effect, because it's not. But in traveling to many places in the world, meeting so many people, and bringing up Schaefer's name and finding out that there's some connection there between Schaefer, them, and their being in the kingdom.
Yes.
So
it's so encouraging.
Yes, it really is.
Yeah, so it really is.
I really appreciate what you've had to say today.
Grace.
So thank you very much.
Thank you for this opportunity to reflect together and remember some of the basic things.